Hello, I'm Dominic Green. I'm Life and Arts Editor of Spectator USA, and I'd like to welcome you to The Green Room, our weekly Life and Arts podcast. This week, I'm casting the pod with Pete Shelley, lead singer and principal songwriter for Buzzcocks. Buzzcocks formed in Manchester, England in 1976. They broke up in 1980, reformed in 1988, and are still going strong. Their first two albums have just been reissued by Domino Records. Pete Shelley, welcome to Spectator USA.
Thank you.
So the occasion is the reissue of the first two Buzzcocks albums, Another Music in a Different Kitchen and Love Bites. When you heard them, how did they sound to you?
Well, it's usually a long while in between me actually listening to their back catalogue, so to speak. And normally when I listen, it's just almost as background. But I had listened to them before because I just had a book of lyrics published, so I had to go and check everything. I've been listening to them about 6 months ago as I was compiling the lyrics for my lyric book. I wasn't really paying attention to it, but when they first started sending over the 24-bit masters from the cutting room, it took a while to get used to how it sounds, because I suppose everything's heard differently now. You either hear it on earbuds or headphones, and it's very rarely that you actually sit down and listen to something and it's full splendor.
When I hear that music, I still feel, I mean, to quote one of your lyrics, almost like I'm 16 again. But is it the same for you, having made these recordings, hearing them again, as you're saying, in this modern sound and so on? Do you feel yourself in touch with that time again?
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, that's the power of music, isn't it? As it brings back memories like a waft of perfume. It brings the memories flooding back, or the taste of ice cream or something.
Luke Haynes, who's written this week a tribute to Buzzcocks, has a complex theory that there are actually three Buzzcocks. There's the initial band with you and Howard Devoto, and then there's the Buzzcocks of Singles Going Steady, the melodious radio hits. There's also another band going on at the same time, which is an experimental European art rock band. Does this theory sound familiar to you?
I think if you were to split it up into those categories, you could get three bands. Like
it would be three different royalty streams as well, of course. But there is quite a difference. I remember noticing at the time when I discovered Buzzcocks, that there's a very wide range of sound involved, because most punk bands have one dimension to what they do, generally. The Ramones being the classic example. Mm. But Buzzcocks always not only sounded completely unique, but surprise you from one track to the next. Was that something you thought of deliberately, or was it just the way it developed?
Well, I think as far as the singles were concerned, each single came from a different recording session. And so even though they were a few months apart, they were probably in different studios. Well, they were in different studios mainly. And so, but would lend to the idea that the sound, it would sound different. But I think there was also a sort of a progression in the way which we approach recording and just how we were more at ease in the studio. Because at first, when we first went into the studio, last year, Domino released a box set of Time's Up, which was really our first demo recordings. And we went on a Saturday morning in 1976 in October. And it was basically done live on a four track. And the recording engineer said we were the fastest thing on two wheels. So it was basically go in and lay down as many tracks as you could in the shortest time possible. But as this is the inevitable mission creep when you become a recording artist and you then spend longer and longer in the studio trying to do things. So, I mean, but there would be that progression. I mean, I think with that theory, but one of the important bits would be that the singles were done as singles, and therefore they weren't meant to be very. I think Why Can't I Touch It was the longest. And that was a B-side anyway. So as a single, you were really looking at short, punchy songs. And so we had those, And so we also had songs which were a little bit longer and took time to get into.
Something like Why Can't I Touch It is an interesting piece of music to me because it sounds like more like a piece of funk or soul music in many ways. Certainly the way it's, if you were to look at it written out on paper, it would be closer to a funk jam than to a piece of rock and roll. What were you listening to when you were writing these songs?
I was listening to lots of the German krautrock bands, in particular Can, who by that time I think were more into the sort of longer than usual form phase, and less rock, and they had more an exotic feel to them.
There was also, a lot of very good melodious pop music being written at the time. People like ABBA, for instance. Were you listening to them deliberately or accidentally, or were they just in the air? Do you feel that there's a connection to that sort of very melodious 70s pop music in there too?
Yes, I would definitely say that ABBA were a guilty pleasure of mine.
Well, they are everybody, aren't they?
I think it's only recently that people can actually come out of the closet and say that.
Is it the introduction to Pretty Vacant, which was taken from SOS by ABBA, I think?
Yeah. Oh, right.
So you weren't alone in that.
I would never have spotted that.
That's what they say. The album Another Music in a Different Kitchen came out in early 1978, and then in the same year, Love Bites came out as well, which by modern standards is astonishing, where people put out an album every 2 or 3 years or something. You actually put out two, plus lots of extra singles and B-sides, in the space of a year.
Yeah, that was a complete madness on our part.
And you were writing these songs as you were going.
Well, I had some songs already under my belt. I'd started writing songs in 1973. But when Buzzcocks came, there was a whole new batch of songs which we wrote. But there were ones which I had, that I'd play at rehearsals and people would say, oh, that's a good one. And then I would say, right, away we go with that one. And that was a one less to write on the spot.
When you were writing on the spot, how did you and Steve Diggle work? In fact, how did you meet? We should begin at the beginning, or begin in the middle, because you'd already started working with Howard Devoto from late 1975 onwards, I believe.
Yes, that's correct. In February of 1976, we found out about this band. All we really knew about them was that they said they were into chaos, and that they liked, and they also played No Fun by the Stooges. And we went down to London, me and Howard, and saw this band, the Sex Pistols. But we got talking to them afterwards, and the manager said how they wanted to play outside of London. So we thought, well, we could get them on at our college. But unfortunately, nobody was interested. And so we hit upon the idea, well, let's hold the show right here and just hired a hall and invited them up, sold tickets. And I was in the box office collecting the tickets off people as they were coming in. And we'd had a phone call from a bass player, but we didn't know who it was. Malcolm said, I'll just go and see if I can drum up anything. So he was like, a fur-grown showman, step right up, come and see the Sex Pistols from London. And there was somebody waiting on the steps. And he said, come inside the Sex Pistols. He said, no, I'm waiting to meet a guitarist. And so Malcolm said, are you a bass player? And the guy said, yes. So he said, well, come inside. They're in here. And he came up to the box office window I was behind. And he said to me, here's your new bass player. And there was a rather bemused-looking Steve Diggle. So I said, well, if you go up to the bar, I'll see you later. And it took us about 10 minutes to realize that he'd answered a different advert to the one which we'd placed, and he was meant to meet somebody, but which went somewhere to explaining the other guy that Malcolm brought in, saying, and here's your guitarist, which was the guy who Steve was supposed to meet. Anyway, once we decided that, it was almost time for the Sex Pistols to come on. So I said, well, but come and watch this band. You might be interested. And he was, and the next day he came for a rehearsal and we both plugged into the same amp and the rest is history.
Well, yeah, it is.
The way we used to work in those days, do long sound checks. And so I would play little bits of things and, you know, we'd work on things. So, I mean, a song like I Need, that started off in December of 78. And we were playing but just the riff. And then when it came around to recording the album, we thought, oh, well, let's do something with that. And that became I Need. So it was just, you know, somebody who come up with an idea and we'd see where we went.
And you were touring constantly as well as recording in between.
Constantly, yes. Yes, I mean, we used to release a single every about 6 or 8 weeks and an album every 6 months in the early days. But we'd always do a huge tour of Britain. It was possible to do, 30-day tours of Britain every couple
Which
of months.
Now nobody would attempt to do. Maybe they do it once a year, perhaps, or even twice if they were very busy, but certainly not virtually all the time like that.
But not all the time. No.
It's amazing when you listen to the albums, the speed of the development between Another Music in a Different Kitchen and then A Different Kind of Tension. Yet it's only just over a year in between the release of the two records.
Yeah.
were you aware of this? Could you hear what was happening, as it were, while it was going on? Or were you just following what sounded interesting and were in the flow of it?
It was really something which had its own momentum. We were just frantically playing catch-up, trying to keep up with it. It was an exciting thing to be allowed to be able to do recording and to play a show. So, I mean, some ways it was like being a kid in a candy store, in that you were just doing what you wanted to do, you know, what you'd always dreamed about doing.
And what did the other bands make of you?
Well, I mean, from talking to them, but nowadays they always say that the Buzzcocks were their favourite band. So, because we weren't in London or part of the London scene, so we weren't really competition. And also, I think we had our own originality as far as they were concerned, because we weren't trying to, step in anybody's toes.
I think you were also writing better songs and more sophisticated lyrics than virtually any other songwriter at the time as well.
Well, I mean, that's what we always attempted to do with the band in the first place. It was to write songs which actually, were intelligent rather than being intellectual.
And that you can hear a lot of that in Krautrock as well, that there's a lot of intelligence and awareness that this is a work of art that's being made rather than just something which is entertaining.
In some ways its entertainment value is an added bonus at the end, which is the icing on the cake, is that people found it entertaining. Because really, when we started, we were doing the most uncommercial form of music that we could imagine.
Yeah, it's very hard to imagine that this is now, that sound is now so familiar, the loud guitar sound.
Yeah, it's now mainstream.
It was, yeah, exactly. It is the norm. And in fact, at the time, it was absolutely shocking. And I remember hearing Buzzcocks on the radio when I was 8 or 9 years old and just being astonished, in a way, that you could put something like that onto the radio. the sound of those guitars is just astounding still, in fact. How did you get that sound?
It was just basically turn everything up to 11, wasn't it? I always used to say that punk was like heavy metal played badly.
Or better, when you think about it.
Well, I mean, I say badly because everybody who played heavy metal would always think, oh, I've spent loads of time learning to play my instruments, so I can play all these different scales and things like that. And we wouldn't bother, you know, we'd say, right, you know, as soon as the singer says 4, you start playing, you know. So it was really the opposite of what was needed if you wanted to be a good, but seen as being a good guitarist.
Well, I mean, I don't know whether you considered yourself to be a guitarist and a specialist at the time, but you did play what is probably, I think, the most important guitar solo of the 1970s on What Do I Get, which caused, again, a real fuss at the time because it involves 3 notes.
Is it 3 notes and What Do I Get?
I think it might be B, C sharp and D. I hate to remind you of your own song. But...
Oh, yeah, it is, yeah. I never realised it was 3 notes.
How many did you think it was?
No, Well, I thought you were referring to the solo on boredom, which has two notes, but three, include the last, the final one.
Oh, I see. That's even more of an outrage in that case.
In my student days, I went to a second-hand store, a junk shop, really, and they had a wind-up gramophone. And so I thought, oh, I'll have that. So I bought a wind-up gramophone, and of course, I bought a selection of 78s to go with it. And I always used to like the way that the old time songs were structured, and the idea that the solo isn't a great improvisation, but is just really the melody.
No one else was thinking like that at the time.
Well, I don't think anybody else had the same record.
Yeah. But who else would have been listening to old time songs like that at the time? This is what I mean. It's a very sort of high art way of approaching making pop music, and you can really hear it immediately. And I had no idea that you were listening to that kind of music at the time, but it makes complete sense that the solo should state the melody.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a very, I know that you did an album with Howard Devoto years later called Buzzkunst.
Yes.
There's a very abstract quality to the Buzzcocks. It's a form of abstract pop music when I hear it. That you're combining things in a way that people haven't before, and in a way that if you had been, I don't know, in Weimar Germany in the 1920s, people would have got it immediately rather than being puzzled.
In Manchester in the 70s.
In Manchester in 1975 or 6, or even a few years later anywhere, where if they had heard one of the radio singles and then bought the album and found themselves listening to very experimental music at the same time as those singles.
It wasn't really we were considering that we had an audience. I think the idea that there were people actually out there listening was something which crept in along the way, because it wasn't apparent at the beginning, and we were working so fast that by the time we'd actually attempting to do, it was then afterwards that it reached more of an audience.
Yes, because you broke up after A Different Kind of Tension, which came out in 1979. And if I was to nominate the saddest song to come out of punk, I think it would be the last track on that album. I think it would be I Believe, and which is, you know, after the solos of two notes or three notes, it's the chorus of one line, which is there is no love in this world anymore, which is not something you expect to hear a band at the peak of their powers playing, or a songwriter who has, as you said, found an audience singing.
It was a strange time.
You don't have to go in further into it. It's all right.
Between us actually playing our first gig and us splitting up was only 5 years. So in that, I think there was 57 songs we did initially. So It was a lot done in a very short time. And like I said, because we were up in Manchester, we were a bit isolated from the stream of adulation. And I suppose we never really went in playing the fame game. Mm.
Did you realise only after you'd broken up, or at some point in the 80s, how much of an impact the Buzzcocks had made on people's lives and how loved the band were? Because I know you had a successful solo career, all through the decade, effectively. Homo Sapien, for instance, which is a very important album. Did you only realise slowly? Because you reformed fairly soon afterwards. You know, there have been lots of bands reforming, but Buzzcocks were perhaps the first.
Well, it was 8.5 years. In fact, it's 30 years this year. In fact, we just passed it. In fact, 30 years, and I missed the anniversary, which is on the 9th of November.
Yeah, you see, you're not playing the fame game, as you said, yeah. So you've been reformed for for six times longer than you've been originally
formed. Six times longer than we were together.
And again, typically, that unlike most reformed bands, you've carried on writing and releasing new material.
Yes, more sporadically in recent years. But I think that's mainly to do with the nature of the recording business, which is in a big turmoil at the moment.
Because the money is no longer in studios and sales, it's in concerts and so on.
Yes, I mean, it hasn't stopped us from doing lots of concerts. And our 40th year in 2016, we did 77 shows.
Yeah, that is a high total for a band, and you go all over the place, and you must meet all the time younger musicians telling you what an impact and an influence Buzzcocks has been on the, how they play music?
Yes, I mean, that's really how we found out our legacy, was for the fact that, I suppose just before we got back together 30 years ago, there were bands who were starting to appear who would say that they were fans. And so, I mean, but such bands as REM, I remember having many a drunken night in a bar with Peter Buck while he waxed about how important Buzzcocks were.
Well, I agree with that, absolutely. So as you enter the fifth decade of the band, what is on the horizon for the coming year? Apart, I hope, from the reissue of the Deluxe Collector's remix of A Different Kind of Tension.
Yes. Well, we have that to look forward to. I think around in the summertime it's due to come out, as well as the Singles Going Steady.
Of course.
Well, but we're going to be playing Singles Going Steady at the Royal Albert Hall.
I have to be there.
On the 21st of June. We're going on a Mediterranean cruise. We've got various festivals. We've got the tours coming in. I mean, I think we're booked as far as like November. But there's still gaps and they're being filled. So I'm sure it'll be a very busy year.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, Pete Shelley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to me, Dominic Green, casting the pod with him, Pete Shelley of Buzzcocks, on The Green Room, Spectator USA's weekly life and arts podcast. You can find us and rate us and even opinionate us wherever you get your podcasts from, or you can look for us on iTunes under Spectator USA. Until next week, thank you for listening. Goodbye.